Delivering this week's must-watch workplace storylines, this is Bloomberg Law's Punching In, for those of you listening in Washington and across the globe.
Hey folks, thanks for punching in with us today. I'm Robert Iafola from the Labor and Employment News team at Bloomberg Law. This week I'm joined by Imre Sulai from Loyola University in New Orleans. Professor Sulai is a nationally recognized scholar on the Federal Arbitration Act. We'll be discussing a case involving mandatory arbitration of racial discrimination lawsuits. Thanks for joining us, Professor.
Oh, thanks for having me. Thanks.
Great. So first, a little bit about the case. A former Tesla electrician named DeWitt Lambert alleges coworkers and supervisors at a Tesla facility frequently called him the N-word, insulted him in other ways, even physically assaulted him. Lambert sued Tesla under Section 1981 of the Civil Rights Act of 1866, a Reconstruction-era law prohibiting race discrimination. But a federal judge said the lawsuit should go to arbitration because Lambert had signed an agreement to arbitrate workplace disputes with the company rather than going to court. He appealed that ruling to the Ninth Circuit. Now, the Ninth Circuit has already ruled that discrimination claims brought under Title VII of the 1964 Civil Rights Act are subject to mandatory arbitration. Title VII is the federal law commonly used for discrimination lawsuits. So, Professor, what's different about Section 1981 that might convince the Ninth Circuit to treat it differently, to rule that 1981 claims can't be forced into arbitration?
Sure. That's a great question. There are many reasons why Section 1981 is entirely different from Title VII. If you look at the governing Supreme Court test, courts have to examine the text, the history, and the purpose of a statute to determine whether that statute can be subject to arbitration under the FAA.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the history and purpose of Section 1981, it stands apart from Title VII. Section 1981, the Civil Rights Act from 1866, involved very special enforcement concerns. As you mentioned, Congress enacted this as a Reconstruction-era statute. It was enacted in the aftermath of the Civil War, when we were trying to rebuild as a country. And there was a concern that state courts in the Confederate states would not robustly enforce these claims.
Mm.
So when Congress enacted the statute, it expressed a particular concern with enforcement. Congress specifically authorized federal courts to hear Section 1981 claims, which was very rare at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Today, it's routine for federal courts to have the power to hear federal claims. But back in the 1860s, Congress had not yet granted broad, general powers of federal question jurisdiction to the federal courts. So in order to help ensure the special enforcement of this statute, Congress took the very rare step, this was an unusual step at the time, to bestow the federal courts with power to hear these claims.
Mm-hmm.
And it would have been unheard of to allow the enforcement of this statute to occur through private arbitration dictated by a stronger party.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one reason why Section 1981 is different from Title VII.
And there wasn't much arbitration back in those days, were there?
No. This was at the height of our country's hostility against pre-dispute arbitration clauses. Before the 1920s, pre-dispute arbitration agreements were not enforceable. Courts were very protective of their jurisdiction. It would have been unheard of for this particular claim or for Congress to have intended this claim to be arbitrated back then. This was before the Federal Arbitration Act was ever adopted.
Mm-hmm.
Also,
mm-hmm.
for other civil rights claims like Title VII, the government can bring enforcement actions. And so binding arbitration clauses, they won't really frustrate strong enforcement of other civil rights claims. But this is the one civil rights claim, the Section 1981 claims, that the government does not bring enforcement actions for. So Section 1981 claims, in other words, they're only enforceable by private parties. So arbitration will frustrate the deterrent and punitive goals of Section 1981 more intensely than other civil rights statutes. And so I think that, you know, today the Supreme Court has said that generally every claim can be arbitrated. It's a very low bar for arbitrability, but out of all possible statutes, I think this is the very best statute for the court to hold that it's not subject to arbitration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, at the recent oral arguments, Lambert's attorney had suggested that forced arbitration of 1981 claims would essentially gut the statute. Now, during those oral arguments, the judges didn't ask Tesla's attorney a single question. That seems like a pretty good sign for the company to me. What are Tesla's strongest arguments for mandatory arbitration of 1981 claims?
Yes, if you look at the Supreme Court's Gilmer decision from 1991, the Supreme Court said that courts have to examine three things to determine whether a statute can be arbitrated. Mm-hmm. They have to examine the text, the history, and purpose of that statute at issue. And if you look at Tesla's counsel during oral arguments, you notice the arguments. Tesla's counsel tried to tweak this Gilmer test a little, changing it from three factors to one factor. Tesla heavily focused on just the text of the statute, saying, don't even look at the purpose and history.
Mm-hmm.
Because the purpose and history suggests this is a unique statute that should not be arbitrated. But Tesla's strongest argument there, if you look solely at the text of this statute, the text is indistinguishable from every other statute held to be arbitrable.
Mm.
Because just like other statutes, such as Title VII, there's nothing in the text of Section 1981 that explicitly would ban arbitration of such claims. So Tesla's main argument is that looking at the text of the statute, the text doesn't bar arbitration in any way. But if you look at the Supreme Court's governing test, it's to look at the text, the history, and the purpose. And for the history and the purpose, I think the plaintiff, the employee, has the stronger arguments here.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you mentioned this earlier, that should the Ninth Circuit rule in Tesla's favor, it would fit right in with the overall trend among federal courts when it comes to enforcing workers' arbitration agreements. That's correct, right?
Yes, that's definitely correct. The bar for arbitrability of claims is extremely low today, and this has been expanding since the 1980s. You know, since the 1980s, basically everything has become arbitrable in American society, and there are hundreds of millions of arbitration agreements floating around. And I've seen sexual assault claims sent to arbitration. I've seen a court compel arbitration of battery claims,
mm-hmm.
which alleges the defendant intentionally infected the plaintiff with HIV. And so claims are the strongest public interest, and in also that are in need of robust public enforcement, they're sent to arbitration all the time. So a ruling in favor of Tesla and finding these discrimination claims to be arbitrable, that would fit perfectly with the trend since the 1980s of expanding arbitration.
Hmm. Well, we'll be sure to watch out for the Ninth Circuit's ruling on this and see if there's an outlier or if it falls right in with that trend. Unfortunately, it looks like we're just about out of time. So thanks for joining us, Professor Sully.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for having me.
All right. That's it for this week. Thanks, everyone, for listening to this edition of the Punching In podcast. For the latest labor and employment news, check out the weekly Punching In news column at news.bloomberglaw.com and click on the tab for the Daily Labor Report. If you'd like to be added to the mailing list for the weekly news column and this podcast, contact Chris Opfer at copfer@bloomberglaw.com. You can also find me throughout the week on Twitter. My handle is @RobertIofola. We'll see you back here next week.